Good morning, everyone. This is Chair Paul Markwart. I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order for May 8th, 2020. We do have a quorum present, and at this time, I would like to read off the members who are present at this time. And if you are not present at this time, when members do get on the line, we will note that as soon as we can. So members present at this point is Representative Becker Finn, Representative Erickson, Representative Chong, Representative Petersburg, Representative Carlson A, Representative McDonald, Representative Brand, Representative Gomez, Representative Joaquim, Representative Swazinski, Representative Carlson L, Representative Schultz, Representative O'Neill, Representative Lean, Representative Lesh, Representative Davids, Representative Leslegard, Representative Fabian, and Representative Schumacher. So as I said, we do have a quorum. So at this time, we're going to, I'm going to give a few reminders for everyone that this meeting is called to order under House Rule 10.01. And members, if you want to be recognized, you have a question, comment during this meeting, be sure to text our committee administrator, Mr. Jessen. He will notify me that you want to speak. I will then recognize you. You need to unmute your phone, or maybe Mr. Jessen will do that, but to unmute your phone, hit **, and then make sure your speaker phone is off. And so I think there's only going to be one voice vote today, and that is going to be on the minutes. Also for members and the public, that if you want to get all of the documents that are available for this meeting, go to the Minnesota House of Representatives website, then go to committees and divisions, go to taxes, and then go to the home page of taxes, and on the lower right under attachments, you will find all the documents. So you've got the minutes we're going to approve. You have the May 8th agenda. You have the Delete Everything Amendment on House File 3389 that we're going to be going through. You've got the summary. You've got the tracking sheet. All that information is there. So at this time, we're going to move to the next item on the agenda, which is the approval of the April 22nd, 2020 minutes. Representative Leslegard moves approval of the April 22nd, 2020 minutes. Is there any discussion? So we'll just hold off here. We'll move things slowly, make sure everyone has a chance. I don't see any discussion, so I'm going to call for the vote, and so we'll unmute everyone. So all those in favor of the April 22nd, 2020 minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Very good. The April 22nd, 2020 minutes are approved. Thank you, members. So members, I guess before we start today, just kind of want to go over some things and how this is all going to work out. But I first of all want to thank all members for their patience and flexibility this year. It's been tough. And I also appreciate your understanding that we probably didn't get to every bill we would have liked to have gotten to, and we didn't hear every bill. So things are probably a little more limited than they normally would be. But I don't think anyone expected this pandemic either. So I just on the outstart here, I want to really thank people for their patience and understanding as we move forward with this year. So how will the process work today? This is an informational meeting. So there are no targets at this point. And the reason why we're hearing the delete all amendment to House File 3389 is to give us some flexibility so we can move quickly. So we wanted to get the language out early so we can hear testimony and so forth, so that when leadership comes up with some targets, decide exactly how that's going to work out, we can move quickly with things. And so we're already talking with the Senate on preliminary things and so forth. So I've been asked, you know, when would markup occur? When will a vote occur? I cannot tell you that at this point. So that's where we're at with that. So today the plan is to go over the House File 3389, delete all amendment. We're going to make some comments. Then staff will go over the bill. We then will take testimony. We have a number of people that would like to testify. And then we'll certainly open at towards the end to members' comments and questions. And also, as staff is going over the bill, we'll kind of take each article at a time and go over that, and members can stop after each article and ask questions and so forth. So next on the agenda then is House File 3389, the Delete Everything Amendment, and that is, again, in your materials for today. And so I'd like to just kind of talk about what's in the bill. And I think to talk about the bill, we probably have to talk a little bit about the past, the present, and the future, because today's bill is probably really part of a process. And, you know, last year, you know, there's a lot of things we're not doing this year because they were done last year in the special session tax bill of 2019, which we had, you know, major tax reform and did a lot of federal conformity. And, you know, in that bill last year, we doubled the standard deduction, which provided tax cuts for over 2 million filers, and now about 92% of folks will do the standard deduction, which will greatly simplify things. Last year, the first income tax rate cut in 19 years, expanded the working family credit to almost 400,000 families, increased the Social Security income tax subtraction, had some property tax relief for businesses, $50 million cut on the CI statewide tax, $30 million of local government aid and county program aid went out to cities and counties. The ag to school credit was ultimately phased up to a 70% credit on school building bonds, and there was an angel investment credit. So, you know, a lot of things that were done last year probably helped senior citizens and families and farmers and small businesses be a little more prepared, I guess, for what people didn't see coming, and that was this COVID-19 as they headed into 2020. And so that's why, you know, a lot of things aren't being done this year because they were done last year. And then today's bill is certainly going to be the present, and the future is, even with the bill we have right now, there is still much work ahead, I see, yet this year. And when I talk about this year, probably this summer and actually into the fall. So we know that businesses and individuals are hurting. They're in tough financial times. And while we're doing a lot of things right now to kind of bridge the gap until hopefully things simmer down, but then we need to move to really the recovery stage, which is going to be the next thing as we work on. And even with the COVID-19 federal dollars coming in, 45% is set aside for local units of government. So that's about $667 million. And so there's still, even after today and after this bill and after May 18th, there still is a lot of work, I think, that could be done here in the tax committee dealing with tax policy for businesses and individuals. So I'm going to move to the bill. Now, House File 3389, the Leadall Amendment, is a bipartisan bill that shows that a little help can make a big difference. And, you know, as you look at the price tag of this bill, it's not very large, but it does provide a significant difference to a lot of Minnesotans who need it. So I want to kind of go over a few provisions that does just that. Just even though there's not a lot of money involved, it does make a big difference. And one of those is in the bill, it makes the student loan credit refundable. And this was something Chair Davids led back in 2017 in that tax bill. And in fact, I think when it left the House, it was refundable. So we're making that credit now refundable. And so even though a lot of student loan payments have been paused, and even those who are continuing, taxpayers still have a lot of student loan debt, and they're facing bigger challenges probably with a loss of income. So this will help taxpayers, especially in these times of economic hardship. Another provision is allowing anyone, all taxpayers now, to deduct up to their first $300 in charitable contributions, and they also modify some things. And so that's important in a time when charitable giving is probably more important than ever. Another provision would allow S corporations and that to file as C corporations. This is, again, this is a Chair Davids bill that would allow kind of businesses to work around that SALT cap, which is that $10,000 limit that the Fed set up for state and local taxes. And so this would allow kind of a workaround on that, and this would provide assistance to Minnesota businesses while remaining revenue neutral to the state. Another area, we do provide for sales tax exemptions for a number of police and fire stations. You know, cities are facing financial difficulties also, and every little bit helps, and these are also important law enforcement facility. So a lot of Republican, Democratic bills on that. We also include dollars for the Alexandria fire in providing some sales tax exemption there also. Also, another area of the tax bill is to make some needed fixes in our tax code. And kind of the main one that we focused on this year had to do with that like-kind exchange, Section 179. We know that the committee's number one priority was full conformity to Section 179. And if you remember our first hearing this year, I mentioned that we wanted to have options out there just in case we weren't able to get to that amount of money. And when I was talking about that, I had no idea we would be facing a COVID-19 situation where we're at and the budget situation where we're at. But what this does is kind of a hybrid of a couple bills. And what it would do is that for 2018 and 2019, where people did these like-kind exchanges and then found out later that they, on the personal property, they weren't deductible. You had to count them as income. They got these pretty large tax bills. So for 2018 and 2019, the full Section 179 conformity would apply just to those like-kind exchanges. So people with those like-kind exchanges would be receiving now the very same treatment as they are through the federal government. So it would take care of that. And then moving forward, it went to the very first bill that was introduced. Moving forward, 2020 and beyond, you would just recognize the like-kind exchange in about 20% of it at about the same amount where you see the Section 179 deduction. So it basically washes that out and eliminates that sticker shock. So the cost is about $8.4 million in the first biennium, and six or seven or so in the next biennium will be on the spreadsheet. But again, that's certainly the low cost, but at least it solves that like-kind exchange fix that really hit farmers hard. So that's that kind of one big piece to tie up on last year's tax bill. Another area kind of fixes in the tax code has to do with the mortgage debt forgiveness. That's in that further consolidated federal act where people have a short sale or foreclosure, they've got this shadow income, and that'd be pretty significant if people had to pay, especially when in that difficult situation. So that's eliminated. The school fundraising sales tax, E through 12 committee tried to do a little tax policy last year. We're cleaning that up. So, then on COVID-19 response, kind of the other areas we, first of all, you had the federal law from last year that we heard that conformity bill. But since then, there's been a couple, maybe three federal bills, including the CARE Act. And so we do a lot of conformity with that. And so we'll talk about that later on. Also, the Department of Revenue had approached us to remove a $50 fee for setting up a payment plan. So the Department of Revenue is working with a lot of taxpayers right now to set up payment plans so that they can pay taxes in a more flexible way that kind of best suits the taxpayer. But under current law, the DOR is required to collect $50 to set up those payment plans. And so the Department of Revenue actually approached us on this and to say, hey, we should not be requiring that $50 payment right now. And so that is in the bill, and I thank the department for bringing that forward. I'll let Chair Carlson talk about kind of this disbursement for counties on late property tax payments. We will can talk about that. So a couple other items that are in the bill is the deduction for volunteer drivers reimbursement. Anything between the 14 cents the feds are allowing up to 58 cents, there'd be a subtraction for that reimbursement. And then there's also $4 million that would go into the Housing Development Fund for workforce and affordable housing. So I guess kind of maybe the main areas, especially when it comes to federal conformity, that is not in the bill is that we are not conforming to the CARES Act dealing with net operating loss laws and excess income loss and also the interest limitation. We are not conforming to that. Between the corporate and pass-throughs, it'd be over $600 million. And so what we actually do in the bill is that we permanently decouple from the feds when it comes to those net operating loss laws. And the idea is that we just can't be kind of tethered to these federal net operating loss laws that would force the state into conformity on things that we can't afford. And, you know, last year in our bill, we conformed to all those things that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act had. And the federal government likes to change things back and forth, and so we've decoupled from that so we can remain independent and not kind of linked to what the feds do every time that would force us to do things. So the bill basically is using limited resources to provide some important targeted tax cuts to Minnesotans. And so at this point, I'd like to turn this over to Chair Carlson, to make some comments on the property tax division portion of the bill. Chair Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Can you hear me okay?
Can. Thank you.
Okay. Well, good morning, members and those that are with us today. I'll be brief since we just had a division report hearing earlier this week. The 2020 Property Tax Division report can generally be divided up into three main policy areas. The first policy area contains temporary changes to local tax codes so that Minnesota municipalities can better deal with the upcoming federal shortfalls that the COVID-19 crisis will cause over the next year. The second policy area contains general property tax items that are not directly related to the crisis, but will make property tax code clearer and fairer for Minnesotans. It also contains small miscellaneous items like local government aid forgiveness for individual jurisdictions. And then finally, the division report contains items that were recommended by the Department of Revenue in its 2020 policy and technical bill. This section also completes the modification projects for state fire and police aids that began in 2019 as part of the special session tax bill. So, those are just kind of the high-level summary of what we passed out of the division earlier this week, and, of course, we'll be available for any future questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Carlson, for that. And so I'd like to move for a walkthrough at this time by staff, and I would ask staff if you would just kind of go over where the major changes are, kind of the highlights. I don't think we need great detail on this. So we will start with Mr. Swanson. We'll do Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is Jared Swanson with House Research. I'm going to start our walkthrough with an overview of Article 1, which is the property taxes and aids article. We will be working off a document titled HF3389 Amendment Summary, which is just the House Research Summary of the DE Amendment. So Article 1 starts with the section that reinstates property tax exemptions for a number of parcels owned by the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe in Cass County. Section 2 expands the list of qualifying relatives for ag relative homesteads to match the list of qualifying relatives for residential relative homesteads. Section 3 establishes a property tax deferral program for an elderly living facility in Duluth. Section 4 amends the 4B1 property tax classification to include short-term rental properties. Section 5 allows the spouse of a deceased veteran a one-time transfer of the disabled veteran's homestead market value exclusion. And Section 6 is the provision that allows counties a second settlement date for first half property tax payments that Chair Carlson mentioned. Finally, Mr. Chair, members, the remaining two sections in Article 1 provide LGA penalty forgiveness for the cities of Sargent and Roosevelt. And that concludes Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. So I'm going to hold up just a bit here to see if any members have questions on Article 1. All right, I don't see anything, so we will move to Article 2, and that's Mr. Williams or Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair and members, this is Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to discuss briefly the federal conformity article. Rather than go through this section by section, a lot of it is just changing dates to pick up the new changes in the Internal Revenue Code. I'm going to instead just discuss some of the significant policy provisions that we're conforming to and not conforming to. So the first act we're picking up changes from is the Further Consolidated Appropriations Act, which was enacted last December. We had a pretty detailed hearing on this bill, so again, I'm not going to go through in too much detail. Some of the bigger provisions in that act are exclusions from gross income for discharges of indebtedness on a principal residence, changes to 529 college savings accounts to allow qualified distributions for apprenticeship expenses, and certain student loan payments. Provisions that there's a number of sort of extender provisions related to depreciation and expensing. The empowerment zone incentives are extended. That's another one of those perpetual kind of extenders that's been extended many times before. And then there's also several tax policies that help individuals that are affected by natural disasters. There's special rules for early retirement withdrawals, special rules for charitable contributions, and special rules for casualty losses. The second federal act that we're conforming to in this article is the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which is enacted in March of this year. The only provision here that really has an effect on state liability is there's a limitation on wages used to claim the employer's sick leave and family medical leave credits. So the federal government established a 100% credit for certain wages or certain wages that were paid as part of sick leave or family medical leave. But to sort of prevent businesses from double dipping, the federal government disallowed the ability of those businesses to deduct those wages. And so the state is just picking up and conforming to that limitation on the deductibility of wages. I think it's actually put into effect by increasing businesses' income by the amount of the wages used or by the amount of the credits claimed. The last act that the bill is conforming to is the Coronavirus Relief Aid Relief and Economic Security Act, or the CARES Act. Some of the provisions we're conforming to there include, again, special rules for early distributions from retirement accounts, the $300 above-the-line charitable contribution deduction that Representative Marquardt mentioned. There's an exclusion from gross income for student loan payments made by employers. It's up to $5,250. And it's for amounts paid just this year after March 28th. And there's also some expansions on limitations for charitable contributions made by C corporations. And then I'll briefly talk about some of the provisions in those acts that the bill does not conform to. The first is the CARES Act included another limitation on the deductibility of wages that are used to claim an employer retention credit. The bill is not conforming to that limitation. It's essentially establishing a state subtraction. So businesses that claim that employer retention credit can additionally subtract those wages at the state level, even though they would not be deducted federally. The bill also does not conform on the above-the-line deduction for tuition. That's one of those extender provisions that the Consolidated Appropriations Act extended to 18, 19, and 20, and the bill does not conform to those. And I'm going to hand it off to my colleague, Mr. Clayman, to talk about the laws.
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, there are a few other items of nonconformity in the CARES Act that are in Article 2, and those have already been touched on, but briefly, those three provisions are the changes in the CARES Act to net operating losses, which were discussed in the committee this year, the change in the taxable income threshold for net operating losses from 80% to 100% for three taxable years, 18, 19, and 20, the changes to the ability to carry back losses from those years, 5 years, and then the business interest deduction limit on, which is an adjustable taxable income limit, that went from 30% to 50%. Article 2 would not conform to that. And then also the suspension of the limitation on offsetting business losses against non-business income, the excess business loss provisions. What Article 2 would do with respect to those three items in the Federal CARES Act would be a permanent decoupling from those provisions. So with respect to losses, and the business interest deduction changes, essentially what would happen is that taxpayers would add back their federal NOLs, and then they'd be able to take at the state level for a state NOL the amount of NOLs that they were allowed to take under the current rules under state law, which are, of course, the TCJA's rules for losses. And that would also apply to the excess business loss provisions and the 163J, this is the business interest deduction provisions as well. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Thank you, Mr. Clayman. Mr. Williams, so I'm going to hold off. Is there any questions on Article 2? Okay, I don't see any, so let's move to Article 3 in the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Clayman.
Yep, Article 3, again, I think we'll just go through the highlights here in Article 3. The first thing to note is that this is the article where the hybrid approach on the like-kind exchange, Section 179 provisions are in. And just to reiterate, for tax years 2018 and 19, any property that was acquired in an exchange, any depreciable property, would be allowed 100% expensing, as you know, currently exists under federal law. And then prospectively, beginning in tax year 2020, taxpayers would be able to essentially pay back the gain, the tax on the gain that's due on the property that was acquired in an exchange, in a manner that for the most part times that out over a period of years, similar to how the subtraction for Section 179 is also taken under current state law. And then, Mr. Chair, I'm going to pass this over to Mr. Williams to discuss the rest of Article 3.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Mark Wharton, members. So the other significant changes in Article 3, all of the other changes are the bill establishes a state subtraction for volunteer driver reimbursements. That's for driving for charitable organizations. We heard this bill earlier in the year. The changes that are in this version are the provision actually sunsets after 10 years. The bill also includes the bill we heard last session to make the student loan credit refundable. Representative Marquardt described that briefly. There's also a bill that excludes from gross income student loans that were discharged due to death or disability in 2018. And then there's a bill that we heard earlier this session that required the department to complete a report on free filing options. And that bill, there's been one change since we heard it in committee. The due date for the study has been pushed out to January 2022, and the appropriation has also been pushed out to fiscal year 2022. And that concludes Article 3, and I believe my colleague, Mr. Klim, is going to take over for Article 4.
Very good. Members, anything on Article 3? Okay, we're going to move to Article 4. Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, Article 4 is the C-Option Corporation section.
This is Mr. Klayman.
Yep, this is Mr. Klayman. Klayman. Sorry. Yep.
Very good.
Yep.
Sorry. All right. Just so we know, Mr. Klayman, please proceed.
Yep, for the record. So this is the C-Option Corporation article. This is the bill that allows a pass-through entity to elect and file and pay their state income tax as a C-Corporation. This was House File 871, Representative David's bill. This was heard and amended in the Taxes Committee this year. There are a few changes, and I think I'll just, for this article, just stick with what those changes are. One change is that if that C-option election is revoked, then a pass-through, that revocation would be effective through the close of the taxable year in which that was revoked. And then that's done to ensure that there aren't what that would do is it would apply all the administration and compliance requirements under Section 289A to that C-option corporation through the taxable year. And that would prevent a situation where there could be a liability that the member of a pass-through on an individual basis might have under that chapter. There are some other changes. There are some compliance-related provisions in this bill related to what happens if the member of a C-option corporation tries to assign income, and so this bill would address that as well. And that's where there's a provision for a credit paid to other states. Again, that would only be related to the situation where a C-option owner assigns income through the C-option, and they would also get the credit, but that wouldn't apply to any of the income of the C-option corporation that is apportioned to the state. Section 8 in this article contains a number of new provisions. Just generally, these provisions are designed to determine how the interaction between the C-option corporation and the individual owners of the pass-through are going to be worked out in a variety of situations relating to credit carryovers for things like Section 179, what happens when the C option corporation, you know, the election lapses or it's revoked, what happens to those carryovers. It also addresses situations where individuals might have their own carryovers. Can they bring those to the C option corporation? This section also addresses refundable and non-refundable credits. It also addresses refunds, so there's an issue here, too, of, well, what happens to the refunds under a C-option election? Do they get paid to the corporation or the individual partners? And again, the changes in Section 8 would say, well, those refunds go to the partners, and the refundable credits would go to the partners as well. And then there's a provision in Section 8, too, relating to estimated tax payments, which are due for a taxable year prior to when that taxpayer files. And so what happens if there's a revocation or of the C option election for that taxable year? If that C option corporation has made estimated tax payments and then they're no longer a C option, there's a provision that specifies how those estimated tax payments are applied to the individual owners of the pass through. And Mr. Chair, I believe those are the big changes to the C option bill. The remaining sections are sections that were already in the bill as amended that was heard in the Taxes Committee this year. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 4.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Klayman. Any questions on Article 4? All right, seeing none, we're going to move to Article 5.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Please proceed, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, this is Pat Dalton with House Research. Article 5 is a sales and use tax article. It's a very short article. Basically, it has four provisions. As Representative Marquardt mentioned earlier, we are fixing a we are making a correction to fix a problem caused for the fundraising sales by student groups that was caused when the education bill last year changed some accounting requirements for schools. Section 2 contains all six bills that were heard to provide construction exemptions for fire or police stations. Sections 3, 4, and 6 all deal with the fire in the city of Alexandria. 3 and 4 deal with a sales tax exemption for reconstruction. And Section 6 is a one-time grant available till June 30th, 2022 to pay some of the costs of mitigation. And then Section 5 is a provision that allows the Minnesota State High School League some flexibility. Currently, they have an exemption from sales tax on their tournaments and regional competitions and things like that. That money normally, from that foregone sales tax revenue, normally is transferred to a nonprofit for scholarships for this school year and the next school year. The league may retain up to $500,000 of that foregone sales tax revenue to help with budget problems caused by the fact that all of the regional tournaments were canceled. And that concludes section Article 5 of the bill.
And, thank you, Ms. Dalton.
And Ms. Hagler will cover Article 6 and the rest of the bill.
Okay, so let's go to any questions on Article 5, remember. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. See no questions. Ms. Hagler, if you could go to Article number 6, and then when you get this Article 7 through 10, which is just the policy and technical bill, if you would just note the differences in those, and we'll just take these all at once, 6 through 10, but on 7 through 10, just if you just do the differences from what was heard in committee. So, Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Article 6 is the miscellaneous article that contains mostly provisions from Article 2 of the division report. However, there are a few other provisions. Section 1 comes from House File 2601, which Representative Schultz brought before the committee earlier this year. And Chair Markert spoke to this earlier in his overview, and this is the provision that will take $4 million each year from the revenues derived from the mortgage registry and deed taxes and put it towards a special newly created account in the housing fund designed for workforce and affordable home ownership program. And those transfers are made between 2022 and 2023. Next, Section 2 temporarily authorizes the transfer of unobligated TIF increment to a municipality's general fund. These transfers can be made through December 31, 2021, and the provision contains requirements for a public hearing and modification of the district's TIF plan. Sections 3 and 4 have to do with extending the 5-year TIF rule for redevelopment districts that are certified after June 30 of this year and that are also located in Greater Minnesota. These provisions extend the 5-year rule to 10 years, as well as the 6-year rule that requires increment to be spent on decertification for those districts will be extended to 11 years. Sections 5 and 6 modify statutory local lodging tax authority to include accommodations intermediaries in the tax base and will allow changes in tax remittance dates. Under these sections, local lodging taxes will be assessed on the whole price of the lodging service provided. Section 7 is similar to Section 2 in that it allows temporary flexibility on the use of revenues from most local sales taxes. This revenue may be diverted to the municipality's general fund also after public hearing through December 31, 2021, so long as the revenue is unencumbered. Section 8 establishes a local sales tax working group, and it specifies the members of the group as well as directs the group to assess capital projects that may qualify as a project of regional significance for local sales tax purposes. Section 9, Chair Markert explained that this one allows the commissioner to waive fees associated with entering into a payment plan. And lastly, Section 10 just contains the tax expenditure purpose statements for the volunteer driver subtraction that Mr. Williams explained, as well as the various sales tax exemptions for local fire and police stations that Ms. Dalton explained. And that concludes Article 6.
Very good. So if you would, on Article 7 through 10, Ms. Hagler, just what were the differences from what we heard in committee?
Mr. Chair and members, the department's policy and technical bill was heard in both the full taxes committee and the property tax division, and here in the omnibus tax bill, those are merged, and the only changes that were made is that the partnership article has been removed.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Hager. Any questions on Articles 6 through 10? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Article 6, Section 1, it talks about the workforce and affordable housing stuff and money being transferred from the mortgage and deed registry taxes. But as I read this, that money will not be available until fiscal year 22. Is that correct?
Ms. Hagler, I'm going to just give that to Ms. Hagler. Ms. Hagler?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, that is correct. The transfers will run from fiscal 2022 to 2032, so there's that 10-year period.
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that money is a couple years away before it could actually be used by someone to put a project together to get a grant or a loan. Is that right?
That's my understanding, Representative Fabian, yes.
So, okay, thank you.
You bet. Seeing no further questions, we're going to go to the spreadsheet. Thank you, presenters. We're going to have about 4 minutes. So, Ms. Templin, Ms. Schill, I'm going to give you about 4 minutes because we have testifiers, and I want to make sure we get at least 20 minutes for members' comments and questions and so forth. So, Ms. Templin, Ms. Schill, I am going to give you a difficult task to give the highlights of the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair, this is Cynthia Templin. I just want to pause to see if you can hear me.
We can. Please.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. 4 minutes. We'll go for it. Okay, members, you should have a spreadsheet. First of all, let me identify myself, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal. You should have a spreadsheet in front of you that's about 7 pages long. There is a cover sheet on this spreadsheet. There's about 5 pages of tax policy changes and about 2 pages of property tax changes. Very briefly, the cover sheet shows the just briefly that the overall revenue reduction in fiscal 2021 for tax policy on line 5, that is about $31 million in fiscal 2021 and about $5.6 million revenue reduction in the tails. I should just pause briefly to also remind members that all of the estimates in this spreadsheet have been updated based on the May interim budget projection that was published earlier this week. In addition, on line 6, the House File 3389 also spends $150,000 for property tax aids and credits in the fiscal 2021 biennium, and about $8 million in the tails. Total revenue reduction is about $31 million in the current biennium and $14 million in the tails. There is also a small non-general fund impact on line 15 that you can see on the summary page. The first 2 pages of this spreadsheet are federal conformity changes, and you can see the estimated changes for each act very briefly on page 1. You can see the estimated revenue reduction with the Further Consolidated Appropriation Act. We heard that bill, House File 3245, and the only change compared to what we heard in committee is on line 5. There's nonconformity to the extension of the above-the-line tuition deduction. That proposal spends in total on line 34 with nonconformity to that provision about $21 million in the fiscal 2021 biennium and a revenue gain of $2.4 million in the tails. Page 2 of the tax policy spreadsheet, there is, again, it shows the revenue changes for the CARES Act. A committee discussed this estimate a few weeks ago, and these estimates, again, were updated for the May budget interim projection. The only change compared to what was discussed a few weeks ago are on lines 34, 35, and 36. The House File 3389 does not conform to these provisions, the NOLs, the employee retention credit, and the modification of the limitation on losses. The CARES Act has a revenue reduction of $32.4 million and a gain of $14.6 million in the tails, and that is on line 49. Lines 51 through 65 show the revenue impact of the Families First Act. There are no changes compared to what was discussed in committee last time. Page 3 of tax policy, moving pretty quickly, you can see lines 72 through 83 are in Article 3 of House File 3389. Mr. Chair did discuss line 72. This is the full Section 179 expensing, retroactive for like-kind exchanges. The revenue impact is revenue reduction of 3.7 in 2021 and 4.6 in 22 and 23. There's also additional revenue reduction to corporate C corporations, and that revenue impact is listed on line 81 of the spreadsheet. The other provisions have been covered in the summary, so I will not go through them. Moving along on line 85 of the spreadsheet is sales and use tax changes. Most of these bills were heard in the tax committee with the exception of line 86. This is the exemption by refund for properties destroyed by fire in the city of Alexandria. This has a $330,000 impact in fiscal in the current biennium. Line 93 of the spreadsheet is also new that was not heard in committee. This is the exemption by refund for the fire station. This is for the city of St. Peter. This has a $130,000 reduction in the current biennium. Moving on, line 98 of the spreadsheet, this is under miscellaneous. This, Mr. Chair, provided a description of a payment agreement fee waiver. This is a temporary waiver that expires on June 30th, 2022. The estimate is a revenue reduction of $2.2 million in the current biennium and about $2 million in details, and the estimate is that about this would waive about 40,000 payment agreements, the fee of $50 on about 40,000 payment agreements. The line 99 and line 100 of the miscellaneous section are provisions from the property tax division. Line 99 of the spreadsheet has a small revenue reduction of $10,000 in the current biennium. It is an exemption to the state general levy of exempt tribal-owned land. Page 4 of the tax policy spreadsheet, moving very rapidly.
And, Ms. Templin, you got about 1 minute.
Oh, my goodness. the revenue reduction in the current biennium for all of the changes in this tax policy provision is about $31 million, and the revenue reduction in the tails is $5.6 million, and again, these are all to the general fund. That concludes my overview of the tax policy section of the spreadsheet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Templin. Ms. Schill, anything to add?
Mr. Chair and members, this is Kathy Schill from House Fiscal. I will point out that the last two pages of the spreadsheet are very similar but not exact to what was provided in the division report. The summary lines, you will see lines 1 through 5, gives all the background information with respect to the May budget projections, and then the proposed changes that you'll find on these last two pages of the spreadsheet. On line 4, the total changes for aids and credits is the $150,000 that Ms. Templin mentioned going over the summary page, and then an $8 million figure in the tails fiscal 22 and 23. Those two changes can be tracked to the very last page of the spreadsheet, looking at lines 27. This is the City of Alexandria fire aid of $150,000, and line 28. This is the House File 2601, Representative Schultz's housing development fund. This is the $4 million that Representative Fabian was asking about. Yes, this is the impact begins in fiscal 2022 and will go forward. This is actually a transfer of funds because counties remit that mortgage and deed revenue on a monthly basis, but this transfer to the Housing Development Fund happens on September 15th of each year. This was the best way to structure it so there is transparency and an actual date where the Housing Development Fund can anticipate the monies coming into the fund. And so it would be $4 million per year for 10 years from fiscal 22 through fiscal 31 would be the last year of that transfer. Mr. Chair and members, that concludes the presentation of the spreadsheet.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Temple and Ms. Chill. Thank you very much. I don't see any questions, so we're going to move to public testimony. We're going to change the order a little bit. We're going to have Commissioner Bowerly go last because there might be more discussion. So we're going to start with Patricia Nauman, and if you could please keep your comments to 2 minutes or less. And members, if you do have a question, you know, you can ask after each testifier, but we've got till 9:32, and I want to give members plenty of time yet. So, Patricia Nauman, if you are on the line, if you'd introduce yourself and provide your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
We can.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. I'll keep my comments to 1 minute if I can. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. And before I comment, I would also like to thank Property Tax Division Chair Carlson and members of the Property Tax Division for their work with us this year. Metro Cities would like to express its support for provisions in Article 6, Sections 2 and 7 that allow a temporary flexibility in the use of unobligated TIF increments and certain local sales tax revenues. These provisions will provide an important tool in the proverbial toolbox at this time for cities as they work to address the unexpected and significantly challenging local service and fiscal needs that are emerging as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Article 6, Sections 3 and 4 do extend the TIF 5-year rule for redevelopment TIF districts in Greater Minnesota, and Metro Cities would encourage you to consider providing an extension for redevelopment TIF districts in the metropolitan area as well. In 2009, during the recession, Metro Cities did support an extension of this nature that included metropolitan area districts, and we would encourage you again to consider including metro TIF districts as cities do manage the implications of the pandemic and crisis. Metro Cities supports Article 6, Sections 5 and 6 that clarify that the collection of local lodging taxes applies to the entire price of lodging, including the services provided by accommodation intermediaries. Finally, Mr. Chair, Metro Cities has previously expressed support for simplifying the process for the local government sales tax exemption as it applies to construction materials. And while this bill does not contain that general simplification process, it does address this issue for specific cities, and Metro Cities does appreciate the step in this direction. Finally, I would just, if I could, would like to congratulate Pat Dalton on her retirement and to thank her for her work with us over the years. It has been greatly appreciated. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your time this morning.
Very good. Thank you so much. Next is Bradley Peterson, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
I can.
Very good.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Bradley Peterson, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. First, I would like to echo our support for the municipal flexibility that Ms. Nauman spoke about previously. We also support those provisions related to TIF and local sales tax revenue flexibility. The rest of my time, I'd like to spend talking a little bit about the local sales tax criteria working group contained in Article 6, Section 8 of the amendment. I would note there's also a letter that was sent to the committee from the League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, the Municipal Legislative Commission, and the CGMC. And the division did quite a bit of work on this provision and sales taxes the other day, and we appreciate all that was done to make some improvements there. But we do still have concerns about the working group and the charge for the working group, because we feel like if we are going to have all of these folks get together, we'd like to have it be a productive discussion that can yield a outcome that local governments and the legislature can embrace. A couple of sort of more specific things. We think that it would be instructive to provide some guidance on what could be considered an eligible project, but it seems counterproductive for the group to be tasked with identifying the types of projects that should not be considered local. We think that any list along those lines that you could create will be, in some cases, potentially over-inclusive and, in some cases, under-inclusive. There will always be examples of things that, in certain circumstances, should be considered potentially, and we think that the working group should have some flexibility there. Next, as a general proposition, the authorizing language for the working group should provide an outline for the group discussions, but should not be prescriptive or mandate an outcome. I think, for instance, the language at page 64, line 21, that the criteria include, quote, documentation of some percentage of regular use of the facility by persons living outside of the local taxing jurisdiction. That certainly could be one indication of regional significance, but there certainly, over the years, I think, have been other legitimate indications of regional significance that have not been so tightly tied to a specific number of users, and that regional benefit can come to somebody who never even uses a facility, for instance.
Mr. Finally, Peterson, if you could send, yes, thank you.
Yep, my last point, Mr. Chair, we also find problematic the prohibition on allowing the committee or the work group to consider measures of economic or tourism development. In fact, this particular directive to the working group appears to be somewhat in conflict with current law, which indicates that a city council resolution on the proposed sales tax should include documentation of the regional significance of each project, including the share of economic benefit to or use of each project, et cetera. In short, there's nothing in the changes to the sales tax statute last year that indicates
Mr. Peterson, please finish up. Please finish up.
There's nothing from the changes last year that indicate that economic development or tourism could not be considered. So we're happy, Mr. Chair, to continue to work with the committee on these things, and we appreciate the time this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. Next up, Joel Carlson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members.
Good morning. Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, Joel Carlson. I have a government affairs business in downtown St. Paul, and I'm here talking to you once again on behalf of Travel Tech, which is an association of travel agents, online and hardline travel agents. And, well, I appreciate the nature of the bill to try and provide relief during this pandemic, and we appreciate everything that the legislature and the governor are doing. In one particular industry, this bill is completely opposite. This bill has a tax increase on all travel agents in the state of Minnesota, and it will make them local lodging taxpayers in an extremely cumbersome way. And I provided a memo to the committee, Mr. Chair, just to make sure everyone knows, no matter how many times you say it, it's not the fact. This is not a tax on online travel agents. This is a tax on anybody who arranges travel. And it's a significant tax. The lodging tax in Bloomington and Minneapolis is higher than the state sales tax. In 2011, you put a sales tax on travel agent services, and we've been paying that. But you've never put that tax on to lodging, because we don't provide lodging. Lodging tax is only applied to lodging that is furnished, and any travel agent, no matter who it is not providing lodging. We think
Mr. Carlson, are you on? Do you have speakerphone on? Some are saying they're having some problems hearing you.
Nope, I don't.
Okay. Very good. Please proceed.
Anyway, Mr. Chair, we just don't provide lodging. We do pay a sales tax on the service fee that we charge, but we've never paid lodging tax, and I disagree with any assessment that says that they changed the law to make these businesses local lodging taxpayers. And that includes every realtor that arranges a short-term rental. It includes every tour group. Everybody who in any way arranges travel is supposed to pay a sales tax on their service. But we are not local lodging taxpayers in all 130 jurisdictions in Minnesota. It is a compliance nightmare, and we hope that you will, again, reject this idea. And we're fine with the sales tax on our service, but saying we have to be local lodging taxpayers just does not make sense and is counterproductive. Nothing has been hurt worse, or few have been hurt worse in business than the travel industry, and this will not help the travel industry come back in any way. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm happy to answer questions, and thank you for all you're doing.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. And members, if you do have questions, you can text our county our committee administrator, Mr. Jessen, even while the person is testifying. We're going to move to Beth Cadoon.
Mr. Chair?
We can hear you. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Minnesota businesses have been negatively impacted, and many have been shuttered to help prevent the spread of the virus. This is placing a serious strain on the continued viability of some employers and resulting in historic unemployment. At this time, we believe it's important that policymakers focus both on the health and the economic well-being of Minnesotans, and tax policies can have a strong role in helping our economic recovery. We thank the chair for including the following provisions. We appreciate the like-kind fix, as this will help small businesses that have had an unexpected tax hit for 2018 and 2019. We would still advocate for full conformity of Section 179 as resources allow. We thank you for the inclusion of allowing pass-through entities to pay taxes at the entity level. This reform is a win-win, as it allows Minnesota pass-through entities to be able to fully deduct their state taxes at the federal level, making Minnesota more competitive and without a revenue loss to the state. We also thank you for the other federal conformity items on charitable contribution and other items that are needed to reduce compliance burdens and complexity. There are two items that I want to flag that will result in Minnesota taxpayers paying higher taxes or not allowing them to deduct business expenses, even if they may be in a loss situation. First, we do not recommend conforming with the provision raising taxes on Minnesota employers by $38 million that is included in this bill. This will be hitting small and mid-sized employers paying employees sick leave, paid leave, and medical leave under the Families First federal bill. We should not erode the federal tax benefits on our struggling business employees by increasing their Minnesota taxes for an expense that is normally allowed as a deduction. Second, we do recommend conforming to the federal interest expensing cap that was passed in the Federal CARES Act. This is targeted at businesses that are experiencing revenue declines and are taking on more debt to survive. A distressed taxpayer could owe cash taxes even after suffering an overall economic loss. Over two-thirds of the states have updated to the CARES Act interest expense limit or impose no restrictions on this cap. So we hope we can conform on that provision. As this bill moves forward, we strongly urge the House to adopt other provisions to help in Minnesota's economic recovery. We'd ask your support of the use of existing tax increments financing paid by the Mall of America to be used by MOA during this crisis. MOA generates over $2.5 billion of economic activity, is a cornerstone of Minnesota's hospitality, travel, and tourism industry. Lastly, we ask for the support of other relief provisions, including tax payment delays and waiver of penalties and interest, as many of these delays can be done with little or no revenue loss to the state, but frees up important cash flow for taxpayers. We also urge you to include the partnership audit rule updates that hopefully can get worked out, Angel Tax Credit, and to make sure Minnesota taxpayers with a PPP loan do not have an unexpected tax hit. We look forward to our continued partnership with the legislature during these unprecedented times to ensure the safety of Minnesotans and to help Minnesota's economy come back stronger than ever. Thank you.
Yep, thank you very much, Ms. Cadoon. Shane Rudling is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Can you hear me?
We can. Please proceed. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shane Rudling, and I represent the Bloomington Port Authority. Thanks again for hearing this provision on local lodging taxes. In this time of extreme impact to the lodging industry in Minnesota, we believe it's time to support Minnesota hoteliers, cities, and convention and visitors bureaus to fix the tax base calculation for local lodging taxes to be equal to the sales tax calculation. As I've testified before, there is a portion of the room fee that is kept by an accommodations intermediary, and currently the state statute does not allow the local lodging tax to be calculated on the total compensation that a person pays for a hotel room. We think the tax base should be the same, calculated for the state sales tax as the local lodging tax. The current law has the effect of putting local Minnesota hoteliers at a slight disadvantage compared to the online travel companies collecting the fee. Minnesota hoteliers support the law. The proposed law, excuse me, Hospitality Minnesota supports the proposed law, and there are myriad companies that manage the sales tax collection function, including one called Avalara, who I've spoken to recently. This proposed bill has no cost to the state of Minnesota, and we urge the committee to support local Minnesota hotelier cities and CVBs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next on the list, Emma Kieske. Kieske?
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
We can. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Markert and members of the committee. My name is Emma Kieske, and I'm here today representing the Medical Alley Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. As the association representing the health technology and care industry, we are fully committed to addressing COVID-19. Our industry employs more than 500,000 Minnesotans and has an economic impact on the state exceeding $60 billion. Now, not unlike other industries, our industry is facing an uncertain financial future. We appreciate the initial steps you are taking to ease the consequences of this pandemic on employers and employees, including legislating the impact of recent federal action on Minnesota's tax code. First, we appreciate the committee allowing Section 179 expensing of like-kind exchanges in the previous two tax years. Although we would prefer full conformity moving forward, we appreciate your actions to reduce complexity and encourage investment. Like the Chamber mentioned, we ask that this committee reconsider conforming to Families First Coronavirus Response Act, as we are concerned employers will face a penalty for providing sick and paid family leave. Finally, we ask that you take action to ensure that employers receiving funds through the Federal Paycheck Protection Program and meet requirements for loan forgiveness are not penalized for doing so through the state tax code. As this bill moves forward to negotiations with the Senate, we hope you will consider matching the Senate's proposal to invest in the Angel Tax Credit Program. The Angel Tax Credit helped launch companies that are returning on the state's investment by fighting the COVID-19 pandemic. For example, Zipnosis, an ATCP alumnus, is leading telemedicine's charge against COVID-19, while another ATCP alumnus, Boss Diabetes, is providing free diabetes coaching during this crisis. Support for programs like the ATCP is key to keeping Minnesota a destination for emerging healthcare solutions, including those that are helping combat COVID-19. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Paul Egger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Egger, and I represent the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to offer some. Oh, can you hear me, Mr. Chair?
Please proceed. Yeah, we're good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief testimony on a few items in the DE amendment. First, I'd like to thank Division Chair Carlson and the other members of the division for their work on the short-term rental property tax classification issue addressed in Article 1, Section 4. The one remaining concern we do have with the language is the 14-day threshold for classification as a short-term rental. Mr. Chair, we do think that threshold is too low and will result in a lot of properties being reclassified to 4B, even though the primary use of the property is, for example, a cabin and properly classified as seasonal recreational. Property should not be classified as short-term rental based on 2 weeks of use for that purpose during the calendar year versus the other 50 weeks of personal use. Mr. Chair, we respectfully request you amend the bill as it moves forward to make the 14-day threshold and at least 30 days. And, Mr. Chair, we do support the federal conformity in Article 2, which extends the exclusion from gross income for discharges of indebtedness on a principal residence, also known as the mortgage debt forgiveness exclusion. And you did a great job of describing that, so I won't go into any more detail other than to share that conforming to this provision is always important, but particularly so in the current economic climate created by COVID-19. And finally, Mr. Chair, Minnesota Realtors joins Mr. Carlson in his opposition to the language in Article 6, Sections 5 and 6, the provision applying the local lodging taxes to services provided by accommodation intermediaries. We do not support expanding the reach of local lodging taxes to the services provided by travel intermediaries, such as a local realtor working with a few vacation rental property owners. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. So last on the list here, I have Commissioner Bowerly. And Commissioner?
You're in. Commission. This is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm pausing to check for sound.
You are good, Commissioner Bowerly. And before you start, I just want to thank you and your department for your great assistance and input and being a very valuable resource to this committee the last couple of years. So thank you for that. Nice to have you here. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate so much the work of this committee and Chair Carlson for the work of the division. It has obviously been a very unusual year for everyone. This pandemic is causing great hardship and unfortunately loss of life here in Minnesota, across the country, and around the world. And as we know from our interim budget projection on Tuesday, the IHS, which is the state's macroeconomic forecaster, has changed its projection from February of a 2.1% annual growth in real GDP to a 5.4% annual decline in real GDP. And as the budget projection told us on Tuesday, that results in a $2.426 billion deficit for the rest of this biennium. And so, Mr. Chair, the legislature and the governor, as we work towards the end of session, we're going to need to work on how to address our current budget situation. And given the uncertainty about the pandemic, our economic outlook will remain volatile for some time. So we look forward to continuing to work with this committee and the legislature to make a plan to address our budget shortfalls and uncertainty as we move forward. I'll turn to the specifics of the tax bill, Mr. Chair, with that caveat that, of course, we will need to figure out the larger budget picture that at the state level, and of course, as that leadership conversation continues, we'll know more in coming days about what we can do with respect to a tax bill. And it may be that we it may be worth considering the approach that was taken last year, which was a revenue-neutral tax bill, and Mr. Chair, yours gets very close to that. We appreciate that. There will be a lot of opportunity for conversation as we move forward. So I would just like to note we appreciate a number of the provisions in the bill. As you know, the governor's supplemental budget included a very small tax provision related to vapor tax and no other tax provisions, but there are provisions in this bill that we do appreciate and are consistent with some of the governor's priorities from past tax bills. We note that in Section 1, the provision that relates to the leak leach band of Ojibwe, that is an issue that the tribe and the county have been working together on for some time, and we appreciate that cooperative work on there. Conformity, of course, is always an issue as we look at what the federal changes are. Certainly, it will be perhaps cost prohibitive to conform with all of them. And Mr. Chair, I think you've made some wise choices in considering which provisions that impact Minnesotans the most. For example, the mortgage debt forgiveness, which is a real burden on those individuals. We appreciate the approach on the like-kind exchange issue that was created in the Tax Cuts and Job Act, which removed the like-kind exchange opportunity for all but real property. This approach is a hybrid, as you've described it. We all know, 179 is an issue that is part of an ongoing conversation, and last year the Governor Walz did include it in his tax bill and supports the issue as we are able to, given our current financial resources. We appreciate that you have helped restore the school fundraising exemption that was inadvertently removed last year by the Education Committee's policy bill. We appreciate the inclusion of the policy and technical bill. We would like to continue to work on the partnership language. We have had long ongoing conversations with stakeholders in that area, and we believe we are very close to some additional language, and we look forward to continuing that conversation. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, at the department, we are working hard to reconsider and look at our opportunities to help taxpayers at this very difficult financial time. And so we appreciate you considering making changes to the statute that requires a fee whenever we set up a payment plan for a Minnesotan who has some tax debt or other agency debt. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll be brief. We look forward to continuing to work with the committee and the legislature to make sure we can address our budget shortfalls and uncertainty as we continue to support the work across the state of Minnesota to ensure the health and safety of Minnesotans and get back to some whatever our economic new normal will look like as soon as it's safe to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. So, members, at this time, and we did get a 10-minute extension till 9:40. So, at this time, if you have any questions for the testifiers or just comments on the bill or questions on the bill, we'll kind of make this time for comments and questions. So, I'll hold up here. If you have any questions, please notify our committee administrator. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this question, I got an email from the City of Warren, and they had had a local option sales tax that was before the property tax division. They obviously were disappointed that that wasn't included. Do you or Chair Carlson A have any comments on that?
Well, I will. Representative Carlson A, any comments on what the property tax division's thoughts were?
Yeah, Representative Fabian, and you know, there's a lot of disappointment with regards to the local option sales taxes. As you recall, we heard every single one of those bills in the property tax division. That is where we spent the most of our time before things got shut down. And through the course of all 20 municipalities, two counties, there was a good conversation that took place within the property tax division between both sides of the aisle, and it really kind of helped form my take on more needs to be done in terms of, you know, these two key functions, which are the defining categories, the capital projects, and, of course, the regional significance. We kept coming back to that over and over again. The City of Warren is a very unique situation, and it is one that, you know, I hope they do come back next year with their proposal. I know their needs are great, as well as there are several others, I think, that would potentially meet those requirements. So I want to provide some hope in that come next year that they bring forth their application again for consideration. But at this time, we felt it was prudent to just move forward with the working group and not go forward with any recommendations on any other local option sales tax proposals.
Representative Fabian, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carlson, I appreciate your comments. I can tell the sincerity in your voice. At least it certainly sounds that way to me. And this is a difficult time. I understand that. I'll reach out to the folks in Warren and see what happens. Okay. So, but thank you for your comments. I do appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Yep. Thank you. And I just wanted to note that the fundraising fix for school groups, that, or I should say the initial, was done in Ed Finance Committee, not Education Policy. So it was Ed Finance that, and I serve on that too. We were trying to do tax policy. So Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also wanted to echo a little bit of the concerns with the local option sales tax. I know last year I was successful for one of my communities to get a softball park to have a local option sales tax as part of their way to fund the park. This year I came forward with a fire hall request. You know, the local fire hall is a 1929 structure. And it's in need of repair or demolishment, and they're looking at building a new fire hall. And, you know, I still believe that there are plenty of local option sales tax proposals that were pitched this year that met the criteria. And I just feel I just want to be on the record saying that I feel it's unfortunate that we weren't able to fulfill those obligations this year and allow local electors to decide for themselves whether or not the local option sales tax is still the right fit for their communities. So I look to 2021 as well, but I feel like in some instances, some of our communities can't wait that long. And these projects also will create jobs in communities. And I think at a time like that, that's something that we should also have thought more about in the bill.
Well, thank you, Representative Brand. And I think there's also a larger picture. And I think, you know, those who are strong supporters of local government aid, which I know, you know, most of us are, that unless we kind of decide this whole issue on local option sales taxes, I really believe the viability of local government aid is somewhat in danger if we don't get kind of a handle on the equalization and other things. So I think this is a good time for the study, because I think folks need to know that the way things are going right now with all the local option sales tax, it does put a threat on the viability and long-term use and usefulness of local government aid, because when local government aid was started in 1971, local option sales taxes were prohibited specifically because we said local government aid was going to be kind of the equalizer. So anyway, appreciate all the comments, but there's other issues. Other folks, members' questions. I'm just going to hold off. Don't see any right now. Chair Davids. Chair Davids?
Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Awesome. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to make a couple quick comments. First of all, we might want to review Beth Cadoon from the Chamber's testimony on some of the sick time deductions and so forth. That's a pretty big increase to Minnesota businesses. And also on the property tax, the local option sales taxes, as you know, in the past, I've been generally a pretty big supporter of that, and it is a bit disappointing to see that these communities that are ready to go are going to have to wait. That being said, I would like to, especially today, thank Pat Dalton for her service to the state of Minnesota, to the House of Representatives. As you know, when I was tax chair and we'd have tax bills, I named that group the Dream Team. It was Joe Michael and Nina Manzi and Steve Hines, and, of course, you had House Fiscal. And I think as far as House Research itself, the last remaining member of the Dream Team is Pat Dalton, and I just want to wish her the best, wish her the best in retirement. She was amazing. I did have a question for Ms. Dalton, though, however, and I wanted to know if she knew how many times I asked her if this met the streamlined sales tax criteria. I don't know if she – I think it was 138 times over my tax, 138 times. So, but Pat, you are – a valued member of House Research, and I just really appreciate your service to the state. And again, I just simply wish you the very best in retirement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Chair Davids. Thank you for those comments. Very good. Representative McDonald.
And yes, I would echo, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just echo Chair Davids with Ms. Dalton. Pat, I have just enjoyed thoroughly. You are my favorite. No offense to everyone else, but Pat and I have worked on many projects, and she's helping me out with some important legislation that I'm proud of to help small nonprofit groups and cities celebrations. And just, Pat, you are just so wonderful, and you always got facts quickly to individuals and to myself and the information. I'm really sad that we're not going to be there to send you off in person, but maybe next year you can make a guest appearance so we can give you a hug and flowers and just let you know how much we so much appreciate your personality, your wit, your humor, your expertise. It will be missed, and you are one of the best. So thank you, and God bless, and congratulations on your retirement. We're very excited for you.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Other questions? or comments?
Well, I'm Mark, Representative Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you all for all your good work as well. Thank you very, very much. Your leadership, your fairness, your attentiveness to all members and the different personalities and intricacies of each individual in their districts has been tremendous. Professionalism and your expertise as well and willingness to work with all is something to be very proud of, Paul, and it's an honor to be on your committee.
Well, thank you, Representative McDonald. I appreciate those comments, and it has been an honor to chair this committee. And, you know, I was going to say a little bit of this at the end, but it just, as you say, Representative McDonald, I think the discussion and the decorum of this committee has been nothing but excellent and respectful and honorable, and I think that's what's really made it enjoyable. And tax committee is always a good debate and just excellent members that bring forward just a lot of expertise and a lot of professionalism. Thank you so much. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all of that you have done as well. And I know earlier you talked about kind of the progression of this and so forth. And so I would also echo that if you, as your closing comments, kind of give us a kind of heads up on where we're going to proceed from this point on. But thank you, and thank you for all your work, and I appreciate being on this committee.
Thank you very much. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, first of all, thank you for your work as the tax chair. I do appreciate your willingness to listen to the concerns of all the members. You do a good job, you know, and as I've said in the past, wrestlers really are really good people. So to that point, but beyond that, I do have to express a disappointment that the full 179 conformity with the retroactivity is not in your bill. I realize that you didn't get a target that could allow that. But I've got several of my constituents that are really struggling with this whole thing and payments due, and eventually it's going to catch up to them, and I'm very, very concerned about that. So hopefully we can continue to work as the process moves here, and everybody have a great day and a fabulous weekend. It's the opening of fishing.
Very good. And thank you, Representative Fabian. And, you know, as we kind of said on the outset, I mean, that still is – a top priority is the Section 179 full conformity. And we'll, that's probably going to be more up to leadership agreement at the end on to kind of, you know, what is going to be the target for the tax bill. But that's still the number one priority. Just really appreciate that. So I don't see any further comments. And so, again, I want to thank the members, Chair Davids. I really appreciated your openness and being able to work with you back when I was the lead and you're the chair. We just continued that relationship, but I just have appreciated your work and cooperation and heads up on things and your top-notch professionalism. So thank you so much, Chair Davids, and again to all the members. Thank you, especially this year, for all the patience and understanding. We didn't get all the bills heard that I know some wanted to, and that's, I just wish we had, but I really want to thank you all for that. Want to thank staff, of course, Mr. Clayman, Mr. Williams, Ms. Hagler, Mr. Swanson, our fiscal staff, Ms. Schill, Ms. Templin, Ms. Briska, the committee legislative administrator, Mr. Haydorn and Mr. Rubis, our partisan research, and committee administrator, Mr. Jessen. These people are all part of a dream team, as Representative Davids mentions. And so thank you for all the work this year and in the past and under these very difficult conditions. And of course, I left one out, as I said here, and that is our retiree, Miss Dalton. And I want to echo what's also been said. It's just a huge thank you to you for your 34 years. And when anyone ever came to us regarding a local government aid or a sales tax question, it was to Miss Dalton we went to. And you've been the guru, if you wanted. And, you know, every time, every 5 to 7, 8 years when we wanted to change the LGA formula, you were the one that really led that up. And I think all the members got to learn new terms when you talk about regression analysis or a proxy for something representing something else. And I still remember when accident factors were a proxy for getting more local government aid, and former Representative Rukavina would tell his cities not to salt their intersections during the winter, because not only would it save costs to the city, but it would increase their LGA from more accidents in the city. So we have all sorts of great discussions, but you were the one that had that and put out the runs and so forth. And, you know, that formula that you had so much work to do, Ms. Dalton, is what really gave local government aid credibility, and it was always seen as fair. And that was a big factor, I believe, in the continued existence and strength of local government aid. So your work has directly benefited millions of citizens around this state with your work. And besides your knowledge, just your professionalism, your great attitude, people like Representative McDonald, anyone would come in for a question, you were always there to not only make us look better, but do things to help our constituents. And so thank you for that. And I have to say one final note here is that 1971 was the year local government aid was created. And in 2021 is going to be the 50th anniversary of local government aid. And since you're going to be retired, Ms. Dalton, and have all this time on your hand, the final motion I'm going to make right now is to move to make you chairperson of the organization of the 50th anniversary of LGA and put all that together. I think that would just be wonderful for you to lead that up. So thank you on behalf of this committee, behalf of the legislature, and behalf of the state. So thank you, Ms. Dalton, and Ms. Dalton, we'll give you the last word.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for all of your kind words. I've really enjoyed staffing this committee over the years. It has been a pleasure working with you, but I will also say I am leaving you in great hands. The new tax team is going to be another dream team. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So members, Representative Petersburg kind of asked what was kind of next. I wish I could tell you right now. I just know we did this so we could act quickly with this bill. And quite frankly, we're really waiting for leadership to come up with an agreement as they look at kind of everything in play right now. So members, again, thank you. Thank you for the discussion of House File 3389 as amended. And everyone, have a good weekend. You're going out fishing. Good luck with that. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And with that, members, I don't think anything we need to do. We are adjourned.